This is 3P Theory, the podcast for AEC professionals seeking to elevate their knowledge on green building strategies and practical design collaboration for sustainable mindsets, bringing you changemakers, innovators, and sustainable leaders who have positively impacted the industry. It's time to get inspired, motivated, and fired up to take action towards a greener planet. Here's your host, Mike Brown.
Welcome, everyone. Today we have Matt Short with Axe 29 Consulting. He's going to give us some great insights into some of the trends in the HVAC industry that are related to helping achieve high performance buildings, and also offer some insights into his experience and how he has helped work with some of the teams in the integrated design process. How you doing, Matt? Welcome today.
Doing great, Mike. Doing great.
Well, if you could first start off with giving us a little background about yourself and how you came to be where you are today.
You bet, Mike. Like I said, I work for Axe 29 Consulting. I'm the owner and founder. We've been in business about 10 years, and we provide MEP consulting engineering services. We are focusing on design, build, collaboratively delivered services. And prior to that, I've been in the industry about 23 years total. So for the first 13, it was 10 years in right out of school at a local MEP engineering firm, and then 3 years at a mechanical contracting firm. And learning both sides of the industry definitely have been beneficial for being able to learn and understand what it takes to collaborate on projects, as well as really focus on that type of delivery method and process.
Great. Well, as you know, the podcast is centered around high performance buildings and understanding, you know, the technology, some of the components that go into helping achieve that, and the integrated design process, as I mentioned before. More specifically within the HVAC industry, what are some of the things that you're seeing that are aiding or pushing the envelope as it relates to achieving high performance buildings, or even, I guess, net zero buildings in some cases?
You bet. First and foremost has been our one of the professional societies in the industry, ASHRAE, which is an acronym for American Society of Heating, Refrigerating, and Air Conditioning Engineers. And what ASHRAE has done is they have developed and really refined their standards over the years to incorporate not just code minimum requirements, but also, and more so, high performance and even net zero building standards, design standards. And most recently, ASHRAE has partnered with some of the model code authorities, ICC, for example, with their energy code. And a lot of the information and language that's in the energy code is coming straight from ASHRAE and their standards. So instead of having two parallel paths, now they're merging essentially. And a lot of the information you'll see moving forward is even being developed by ASHRAE and some other professional groups. So that's been good to see. There's less confusion there now, and it sounds like things are really sort of solidified in terms of how the development will work. Mm-hmm. It's sort of like the Blu-ray versus Laserdisc. Blu-ray wins. So, and then also not just with our industry associations, but also with the owners and the end users, they are starting to become more educated. And so that's always good when you work with educated individuals and groups that understand what it takes. The industry has, well, let me say this, another area that's been developing for quite some time now are the rating systems as well. USGBC, Green Globes, there's a handful of other entities out there that have rating systems that support sustainability. They have become more robust, more mature, and even in some cases more applicable. So that's really benefited our industry in terms of what we have to do. And the requirements are clear, again, more applicable, and it's easier to provide sustainable services under those rating systems. Along with that are not just the rating systems, but then also all the players, including trade partners, just the experience of having a few projects under their belt, understanding what the requirements truly are, sort of lessons learned are now, we're starting to see them in our rear view mirror. So that's a good thing. And a lot of the manufacturers have also caught up and are, maybe one way to put it is, on board with sustainability, meaning it's going to be around for a while. So seeing some of the trends of where they're choosing to incorporate and how they're choosing to incorporate sustainable practices within their products is a good thing. Back in the early stages of LEED, for example, finding recyclable material was limited. Where energy efficiency could be taken was limited, not just the products, but also the understanding. So it, all in all, our industry has definitely gone through some of the growth stages that are needed for sustainability, for high performance, for net zero, as that's now on the leading edge of sustainability, sustainable practices. We're seeing more and more of it, and it's really being driven by everything we talked about so far, from the end users to the codes, authorities having jurisdiction, as well as the trends in, you know, with different available products and resources. So definitely come a long way in the last 15, 20 years.
Definitely. Although I've only been in the industry for about 5 or 6 years now, even in that short amount of time, I've seen a lot of growth, especially from an energy modeling perspective, with the tools and software that are available to help model for predicted energy use and things of that nature, especially when the integrative design process is so heavy on starting early to identify what those benchmarks are and kind of directional guidance for certain strategies and things of that nature. I think a lot of tools are becoming more dynamic and agile to be able to use earlier in the design process. So I think that's a really, really great thing in that attempt to achieve high performance buildings or even net zero in that case. And especially with the emerging rating systems becoming more evidence-based to be able to have not necessarily your traditional measurement and verification process, but at least capturing some of those metrics to then complete that feedback loop for the design team and offer some insights to the owner at the very least, especially for projects that are doing multiple buildings of the same type for a certain owner as a part of a portfolio or maybe a school district and things of that nature. Those lessons learned can have a huge impact on future design.
Definitely. The one thing that you mentioned is that made me think of another area that we're seeing more and more sustainable practices being implemented are the schools. And it's not necessarily because the code's driving it there. It's because it can be done easily within the current structure and the way schools are designed and built currently. And so there's some low-hanging fruit there that, and not just schools, but that's really a good process to follow is see what conventionally has been done and where now some of these elements that weren't there before can be easily incorporated in at almost no additional cost or resource to do that. It's just, hey, it's six of a dozen one, there's six of one, half a dozen of the other.
Exactly. Well, I know that there are a lot of different types of facility managers and owners out there. A lot of times when you have these project kickoffs or charrettes at the beginning of a project, the project teams kind of help gauge and understand their perspective as it relates to sustainability or even just the performance of the building and how it's going to operate. What are some of the changes in that mindset, as you kind of alluded to, that they're becoming more savvy and more educated about what this means to them and their business, even from a a developer standpoint or even an owner-occupied facility. What are those changing mindsets from an owner's perspective, do you think?
You know, first off, what I think is important when it comes to the owner and operator, facility managers, that side of the project, it's gaining an understanding of what they want and if sustainable practices and elements fit within that basis of design, we'll call it. And for those that it does, oftentimes there's some level of education understanding there, but definitely there is the ability and sometimes the need to drill down a little deeper and help all, you know, team members understand what sustainability can be. That's one of those words that everyone understands to be, everyone has their own definition of sustainability. That's right. And so getting on the same page up front as to what it can be for that particular project is very often a galvanizing achievement, because if not, then there's these fractured perspectives and everyone sort of sits off on this project of we're going to make it sustainable, and it's not really, everyone is not on the same page. So there is a certain level of collaboration mindset that needs to be taken on any project. And in this case, sustainability is not exempt from that mindset. But speaking more specifically on some of the just end users, I'll call them end users, mindsets, because, and this goes really for everyone on the team, because there are more sustainable ideas, experience, opportunities, and even guiding principles or requirements, I think people are more attuned in general to this sort of, instead of it being a meandering sort of process, I think it's something that people understand more upfront that needs to happen versus, oh, and what if we were to get LEED certified on this project as we're waiting for the permit to get approved? It's being addressed more upfront. So in that case, the end users' mindsets are definitely more forward thinking, and they are incorporating sustainability up front now. We're seeing more of that. It's still a numbers game with the economics of sustainability becoming more cost effective. And even, you know, with the use of life cycle cost analysis, it still has to make sense too. Now, there's some that will set off and say, we don't have a hard, fast rule. We'll figure it out as we go. The ROI doesn't have to be there if they're really passionate about solar.
Yeah, yeah.
But most of them have a rule that they need to follow. And that's where the design team comes in and helps them navigate through making those types of decisions of what makes sense.
Yeah, I think that's really important that you mentioned being able to kind of start early. Although there are some projects where the owner may come in and, you know, the CD phase, or as you mentioned, and while they're in permit to bring up LEED or, you know, world building standard or something of that nature, which, you know, from our perspective, it's like almost unfathomable. But I think that's why even mentioning it in that design charade or you bring up those concepts and ideas, they can start to think about it then. And you can kind of move into that, or if that's not something they want to pursue, then, you know, think about something else, or at the very least have some of the attributes. Because at the end of the day, one of the things I do like about the rating system is that it offers structure for design team members to document and measure some of the sustainable practices, whether it be energy, water, building healthy building materials. But at least some of those attributes can be infused into the project, because then you're still meeting the intent. And that's what I guess matters at the end of the day. You spoke about life cycle cost analysis. And I've been involved in a couple of scenarios in the past where, you know, we may be doing a comparison for certain HVAC systems or lighting packages to achieve a certain energy performance for the whole building. And you know, there's first costs you have to consider, as well as some of the operational costs and maintenance costs, things of that nature, especially once you get on the side of water systems and understanding the cost of water, maybe even treatment in some cases. What are some of the things on the HVAC side or even lighting side that you think teams neglect to include or could be a little bit more expansive? Because you can even almost go as far as to say, especially with some of the well building strategies and intent behind those strategies for occupant productivity, indoor air quality and things of that nature that are kind of have more of a soft cost, but are substantial in some cases. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, probably right on the table, there are some lighting considerations. Lighting controls don't always make it into the energy model the way the current codes are requiring them. And mainly it's because the modeling software has not caught up to the functionality that's required for daylighting zones and controllability, occupancy versus vacancy sensing devices. So sight lighting is another one where it's just not on off. There's dual level controls out there. So there's a lot of lighting control modeling that doesn't necessarily make it in there. And quite honestly, it actually helps the ROI. Because it actually, if your lighting is efficient, you're actually leaving it on more. So that's definitely something that should be taken into consideration that isn't always. On the HVAC side, there's a couple things that come to mind that, you know, what's important? And in terms of whether it's overlooked or just really not even considered intentionally, scheduling of different components, whether it's time of day scheduling, you know, demand control scheduling, a lot of time those, they can get really complex and they can get really detailed. You can really drill down and get as detailed. There are a lot of schedules in a building that may get oversimplified. Now, the long and the short of it is things like that. If you did a comparison, you know, what you'll find is they don't really affect the overall return on investment and your life cycle cost analysis that much. But some of the other things that I will say that move the needle more are when it comes to incorporating architectural non-MEP engineering items into the model. The engineer, MEP engineer, is usually the one that's putting the model together in a lot of cases. And when that happens, they don't necessarily get, receive, or pursue getting that information and, again, collaborating with the architect to work on, is it the percent of glass that we need to figure out or the performance of the amount that we have? Mm-hmm. You know, where's the payback here? Where is it the insulation in the roof? Which one should we focus on? And so there is some communication, collaboration that's required to really compare design alternatives, the right design alternatives. Mm-hmm. And quite honestly, depending on the type of project, single story, high rise, if it's storefront or if it's curtain wall or punched openings, tilt wall, whatever it may be, all that has different implications on or what makes sense to compare in the alternative.
Right.
So those kinds of conversations definitely need to happen. And it's maybe even sometimes best done if in a iterative kind of format where it's not just a one-time conversation, but multiple conversations throughout the life cycle or throughout the life of the energy modeling efforts.
Definitely. Definitely. And what I like about at the federal level for federal buildings and government buildings is that for some of the components that go into evaluating a project already include LCA or life cycle cost analysis and things of that nature when it's applicable. So whether that's solar or solar thermal hot water heating and things of that nature, which I think eventually we'll probably get there from a code perspective. I think it's still quite a ways away, but at least from an energy modeling perspective and performance space, I think we're already moving in that direction away from prescriptive, given, you know, some type of parameters or guidelines based on the building type or square footage and things of that nature. Because, I mean, at the end of the day, and you've probably experienced this before too, you get more flexibility on the design to be able to maybe use, you know, a slightly less performing glass or less performing assembly for insulation and things of that nature, but you may gain another area and so on and so forth to improve the performance of the building. One of the metrics that I'll always mention as it relates to just starting early is, and I've seen this happen in practice and I've seen it in research, is you lose roughly 30% of your opportunity to impact energy reductions on a project once you move beyond the concept design phase, which in many cases, MEP and other consultants aren't even on board yet that early in design. And you're pretty much kind of given a building that you have to use technology. I always reference the energy efficiency pyramid, you know, where at the bottom you kind of focus on the passive strategies and then you kind of move up with technologies. And then as you move up the pyramid, it increases in cost and complexity. And at the top, you may have renewables, whether that's, you know, on-site solar or wind or things of that nature. So I think it's really important to understand looking at the whole picture because, you know, people at times try to isolate certain measures and, you know, that has an impact on other things in the building as well, whether it be a positive or a negative impact. So.
That's right. We just recently had an opportunity to, early on in the beginning stages of SDs on a state project, help with the siting and geometry of a new building for the state. And basically with one of the requirements being an LCA for design alternatives, we knew we would get there with an energy model. You know, through the energy model, we would be performing and providing the LCA information. What one of the benefits of the LCA being required for a state project is it was really easy to preemptively help with that siting and geometry to at least give them some insight and take that piece into account. You're considering a one-story, two-story, or three-story building. You have this amount of area. Here's your site, the orientation of the building. You know, does a 50,000 square foot times three floors stacked in a aspect ratio at 3:1, rotated this angle, what's that give us in terms of total annual energy? And then let's rotate it. Let's start looking at different orientations. Let's look at 150,000 single story, even a two story. So those types of options are available and right off the bat can help drive, if not even determine where this building's going, what it's going to look like.
Awesome. Well, one of the things I try to do in all of my sessions or episodes is try to gain some insight to you as a person and allow our listeners to, you know, get a perspective on, I guess, a little bit about your background and some of the things in your own personal life as it relates to just experience in general. In terms of mentorship, who do you feel either locally, nationally, has helped contribute to the success in your career, your role in your career?
Well, definitely early on in my career, there was a engineer, a PE named Dan Rowe, and who I worked under for the first almost 10 years of my career. And he was instrumental in most of what I know today. He helped me not just gave me information, but helped me understand how to think critically, what relationships were about in this industry in general, and just a overall understanding of how to be a good engineer and what that means. And so there's too numerous to count situations that I run into every day that recall some of the information and experiences that Dan provided to me early on in my career that it molded me into who I am as a professional engineer. There's also, most recently, the leadership side of running a company. I've been a member for about a year with C12. It's a Christian Business Owners Association organization. And in it, there's other peers, not necessarily within the design and construction industry in all different industries, but they're also like-minded and leading their respective companies. So everything that we discuss in there is, it's almost like your own personal company's board. There's a board of directors, essentially, that you get to tap into. And really what it is just other business owners that
have kind of like a mastermind, if you will, or networking mastermind.
You bet. And iron sharpens irons, that's exactly how it works there. There is a, call it a curriculum or agenda that we work through once a month. But that has been a huge help in the development of moving from not just the practicing of engineering, but the building and leading a company.
Right. So outside of work, what are some of your passions or passion, if you will, that you have that maybe you share with people or maybe not at all, that kind of drive and motivate you from day to day and keep you young?
Yeah, well, I tell you what keeps me young. So I'm married with three boys, all under the age of 12, and they keep you young. They, from as soon as they get up in the morning till they go to sleep at night, they're moving, and a noisy house is sort of the standard these days. If it's quiet, something's going on. Something's wrong. There you go. But yeah, so not only being a leader in the industry, but also in the home, you know, those are roles that you have to embrace, or, you know, that things don't work well. So definitely being a father is one of the greatest passions in a man's life or in my life that is rewarding in ways that work can't be or isn't. And, you know, I'm also an unabashed believer of Jesus as my Lord and Savior, and not just the name of the company, but what we do there, how we do it, and even directly talk to people. I really enjoy engaging others and that either have a shared faith or no faith at all, that are wondering about what life's about even. Why'd I call my company Acts 29? That's something that comes up quite frequently, and really enjoy talking to others about, you know, what we do and what I do outside the office, not just inside, but outside. So it's both places, really the principles that we use at Acts 29, it's no secret. They're biblical principles that are used 24/7 in my line of work. So the passion, raising a family, running the company, and loving the Lord, that's pretty much it in a nutshell.
Amen to that.
Thank you.
Yeah, I was going to ask you that question too about why you named the company Acts 29, but I think that may be something we dive into a little bit deeper in another conversation, or provide some of that insight to some of our listeners and some of the online content potentially.
You bet. So anyone that's interested that listens to this podcast, be more than happy to, if they want to reach out, share more about it.
Great. Well, loved having you today again. Thank you. And look forward to having you again soon, maybe in another detailed conversation. I'm sure our listeners enjoyed the content and insights you provided today. And you have a great week, and we'll see you again soon.
All right, Mike. It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to 3P Theory with Mike Brown. If you like our show and want to know more, check out buildingiqpodcast.com or please leave us a review on iTunes or SoundCloud. Join us next time for more insightful knowledge on high-performance building design.